This 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Congratulations from the U.S. President. U.S. President Barack Obama telephoned congratulations to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Thursday, 2 days after the Prime Minister was re-elected to a fourth term. A White House statement says Mr. Obama stressed the importance the U.S. puts on its close military and security cooperation with Israel. He also reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to a two-state solution in any peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. But a U.S. official said Mr. Obama also told the Prime Minister that the administration will have to reassess its policies toward Israel after Mr. Netanyahu appeared to backtrack on his support for a two-state solution. Earlier Thursday, Mr. Netanyahu denied backing away from a two-state solution. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility Thursday for the attack on Tunisia's National Museum that killed 23 people. The Islamic group's statement described the attack as, quoting now, a blessed invasion of one of the dens of infidels and vice in Muslim Tunisia. It was posted in an online forum that carries messages from the group. Earlier, Tunisian authorities said they had arrested 9 people in connection with the massacre. An unidentified warplane attacked the presidential palace in Yemen's southern city of Aden on Thursday. Security forces loyal to former Yemeni leader Ali Abdullah Saleh attacked the international airport in Aden early Thursday, triggering a battle with militia loyal to President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi, the country's internationally recognized leader. The fighting forced the airport's closure. Forces on both sides also fought in other parts of the port city. Officials say 4 pro-Saleh fighters and 2 militiamen were killed in the clashes. This is VOA News. European Union leaders meeting in Brussels say they will not lift economic sanctions against Russia until a ceasefire Moscow endorsed last month for war-torn eastern Ukraine is fully implemented. EU President Donald Tusk announced the decision late Thursday.
Leaders decided to align our sanctions regime to the implementation of the Minsk agreements brokered by Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande. The European Council agreed that the duration of economic sanctions will be clearly linked to the complete implementation of the Minsk agreements, bearing in mind that this is only foreseen by the end of 2015.
Now, Moscow has repeatedly denied lending direct support to rebels in Ukraine's Russian-speaking border regions. It has strenuously objected to a series of sanctions imposed by the EU and the United States. A U.S.-based rights group says both government and rebel forces used cluster bombs in eastern Ukraine in January and February. Human Rights Watch says at least 13 civilians were killed. The group said Thursday that neither side in the conflict should be using such weapons and warned that their use could constitute a war crime. The top U.S. security official says he expects cyber intruders to become bolder and try to find more ways to attack the U.S. and its allies. National Security Agency head Mike Rogers appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee Thursday to say that budget cuts would mean less resources and make critical military computer systems more vulnerable. And Mr. Rogers called on the public and private sectors to help each other in combating cyber attackers. Thailand's Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that a criminal case against the country's last elected prime minister could proceed. Steve Herman reports for VOA.
Thailand's Supreme Court has set May 19th as the date for the first court hearing in a criminal case against former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat. The High Court, in announcing acceptance of the case from the Attorney General's office, declared it had jurisdiction. Ms. Yingluck was forced from office shortly before last year's military coup. She is accused of dereliction of duty and negligence in connection with a bungled rice pledging scheme. Steve Herman, Bangkok.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. The sea ice in the Arctic Ocean has fallen to its lowest recorded level for the winter season. The U.S.-based National Snow and Ice Data Center says the maximum coverage this year was the lowest since 1979, when satellite records began. A recent study found that Arctic sea ice had thinned by 65% between 1975 and 2012. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Islamic State claims Tunisia attack as 9 suspects are arrested.
We need to be absolutely clear about what we face. This is the latest example of extremist terror, and we have to fight it with everything we have.
That's British Prime Minister David Cameron, former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. This is our Washington studio and calls once again for electoral reform in his country. Former South Sudan Vice President says his rebel group is still interested in peace, provided a new mechanism is introduced. And Sierra Leone swears in a new vice president.
The president, Dr. Ahmed Bai Koroma, has just administered the oath of office to the Honorable Vice President Bokari Poe, who until 2 hours ago is our ambassador to the People's Republic of China.
The Sierra Leone government spokesman, Abdoulaye Bireti. South Africa's nuclear program is 50 years old this week, and new machines detect tuberculosis cases earlier in Ethiopia. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisian officials said 9 suspects have been arrested in connection with the museum attack on Wednesday that killed 23 people, mostly tourists. But as Islamic State militants boast responsibility for the attack and the rest of the world mourns, some analysts say the attack could be part of an alarming trend. Viewers Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
11 de nationalité italienne, 11 de nationalité polonaise, 8 de nationalité française.
This is Tunisian Health Minister Syed Aidi listing the nationalities of the dead on Thursday. They are from Europe, South America, East Asia, and North Africa. British Prime Minister David Cameron says the attack requires a global response.
We need to be absolutely clear about what we face. This is the latest example of extremist terror. And we have to fight it with everything we have, whether that is taking the poison out of young minds here in Britain, whether it's working with intelligence and policing and security services in other countries around the world, or whether it is dealing decisively with those areas of the world from which these problems come.
Country Risk Solutions analyst Daniel Wagner says with tens of thousands of foreign jihadis training and fighting in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, returning militants could endanger every country they came from. But he says Tunisia is at particular risk.
It's estimated that 2,000 or 3,000IS members migrated from Tunisia to Syria and Iraq. And the Tunisian authorities have stopped another 9,000 or 10,000 who wanted to go. What that means is that eventually a certain percentage of these folks are going to come back.
Tunisia's developing new government and porous borders are particularly attractive to extremists, says Wagner. The country is a symbol of democracy in the Arab world and a relatively easy target, with fighters and weapons moving freely across the country's borders with Libya.
Tunisia is the only country where there has been what anyone would call close to a successful transition to democracy in any of the countries that were impacted by the Arab awakening. The rest of them have been a disaster.
By targeting Tunisia, the self-proclaimed Islamic State appears to be trying to prove that democracy and their extremist version of Islam cannot coexist peacefully, he says. This attack alone could be a disaster for Tunisia's tourism industry, throwing the economy into chaos. As a result, the political fallout could be a popular call for security over freedom and the return of a police state. On the other hand, he adds, with victims from all over the world, the attack has galvanized the international community and may inspire stronger action to fight the Islamic State. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma has sworn in a new vice president a day after he dismissed Vice President Samuel Sam Sumana. Mr. Sumana has said his purported removal is unconstitutional and unlawful, and he has instructed his lawyers to pursue the matter in the Sierra Leone Supreme Court. The new vice president is Victor Bokari Faure, former Secretary General of the ruling All People's Congress APC party, who, until his selection, was Sierra Leone's ambassador to China. Government spokesman Abdoulaye Bireti said the new vice president brings with him a wealth of experience.
We now have a vice president in the person of Bokari Biktofo, somebody who has served the party up to reaching the position of secretary general for the party, and also the current chairperson for a very long time, His Excellency the president of the party, and also the president, Dr. Ahmed Baikorona, has just administered the oath of office to the Honorable Vice President Bokaripo, who until a few hours ago is our ambassador to the People's Republic of China.
Let me say, all this is happening when the, I don't know whether I should call him outgoing Vice President Sumana has said that his dismissal is illegal and unconstitutional, and that he plans to go to the Supreme Court of Sierra Leone.
Absolutely, the former Vice President has every right to apply to the Supreme Court, because at the end of the day, the Constitution of Sierra Leone, particularly Section 124, makes it very clear that whosoever has a contention with the provisions in the 1991 Constitution of Sierra Leone will have to appeal to the Supreme Court for an interpretation. But that notwithstanding, though, there is a provision in Section 54, Subsection 4 of the very Constitution that says that once the office of the Vice President becomes vacant, the President must fill it immediately. And it is on that basis that President Nkrumah, after due consultations with members of his party and other stakeholders across the country, that eventually the act fell on Victor Bokarifo to serve as the Vice President of the Republic.
How did President Nkrumah arrive at picking Mr. Foe? Was this done in consultation with the Sierra Leone Parliament and the judiciary?
Even though he doesn't have to consult with the judiciary, even though he doesn't have to consult with cabinet, the Constitution gives him that authority. But in this appointment particularly, the President relied on Section 54, Subsection 5, of the Constitution that says in the event that somebody ceases to be a member of a political party as provided for in Section 41B of the Constitution, the President must fill that position immediately.
Sierra Leone government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. The former Zimbabwe Prime Minister and leader of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, says Zimbabwe needs electoral reforms before the next elections. Morgan Tsvangirai has said his party will not take part in any election in the country until the government makes the necessary electoral changes. Mr. Tsvangirai visited our Washington studio Thursday and said he's in Washington to re-engage with various institutions and explain to them that what he calls the deteriorating political and economic situation in Zimbabwe needs global attention again.
What brings me to Washington is a program of re-engagement with various institutions of the United States. You know that after the 2018 election, everyone adopted a wait-and-see attitude. But there are new developments that we would like to engage everyone. It's not just the United States, but I think we need a global reach in order to inform and tell the Zimbabwean story that it's not over until it is over. The crisis in Zimbabwe needs global attention once more because of the deteriorating situation.
You want to tell the Zimbabwe story. Your party has said you're not going to take part in elections. What story are you trying to tell now?
Well, the question is that in 2013, there was an election which was conducted without the necessary electoral reforms. The outcome has been a dispute. It has caused political paralysis, political stalemate in the country. The positive contribution for the GNU years have been wiped out because of this dispute. So we are saying that going into another election without the necessary electoral reform will just produce the very same conflictual positions that will not take the country forward. So we need those reforms, and that's the story we are talking about. We need electoral reforms. We need to create an environment in which elections have a meaning, not just for the sake of going through an exercise.
It seems that recently now there's been some kind of lessening of the sanction tension on Zimbabwe. Well, what's your view on that?
Well, we have all agreed. When I was prime minister, we went around the world, United States, Europe, everywhere to say the sanctions regime, which was largely a targeted tribal ban, was not helping the country and was not having the necessary effect. Because when you put in a sanctions regime, you're supposed to be creating incentives for good behavior. And Mugabe was committing violence against his own people, committing atrocities. And that's what we wanted to contain. Unfortunately, at the end, no one has listened to the fact that the sanctions regime must be removed, if there are any, including travel bans.
The European Union has moved or is moving towards, based on what I'm reading, that they are moving towards easing sanctions on Zimbabwe. The United States still maintains its sanction. What do you think the United States should do?
Well, there are two approaches. The United States maintain a hardline position. The Europeans have relaxed it. But they have said that the travel ban will still retain on the president and his wife. But everyone else has been removed. So as far as I'm concerned, sanctions must never be used as an excuse for the failure of policy and failure of economic and political policy in the country. And that's why, for us, removing these things will actually create conditions where ZANU-PF has no excuse whatsoever.
Morgan Tsvangirai is the former Zimbabwe Prime Minister and leader of the opposition movement for democratic change. He spoke with me Thursday during a visit to our Washington studio. You can hear more of our interview with Mr. Tsvangirai on Monday morning. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, March 20th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Former South Sudan Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar said his group is still interested in peace. But, he said, following the collapse of the recent peace talks in Ethiopia, any new talks must begin with a new mechanism. President Salva Kiir called a rally on Wednesday this week in Juba to charm the people of the three states of Equatoria to support his administration. Riek Machar condemned President Kiir for blaming the collapse of the peace talks on rebel intransigence.
It was a very disappointing speech. I think this was not what people of South Sudan expected from their president, because he clearly stated that he had disagreed in all the points we were discussing. So then how would he hold me responsible when he clearly accepts that it was him who disagreed with the points that we raised?
You have worked with President Kiir as his deputy for many years. You know him very well. What do you think was the motivation for this rally that he held yesterday?
I think he wanted to rally sections of South Sudan. He wanted to rally the Equatorians on this question of that there is a position of Comrade James Wani being taken by me. So he wanted the support. I don't think he got that support. He didn't argue it well. Second, he wanted to mobilize the sections of the Denka community. I think he didn't get the support he wanted.
We are hearing unconfirmed reports that South Sudan peace talks might resume in April. And if it is true that you are going to go back to the negotiation table, with all the accusations that were leveled on you yesterday, do you feel like you want to sit and talk face-to-face with the government again?
These peace talks have been declared unsuccessful. The mechanism which was devised by IGAD has been declared not to have yielded peace. If the new mechanism is going to be instituted, we will send our delegation to pursue the peace process. This is despite all that President Selfa said yesterday. And I think the people of South Sudan are a good judge.
The international community and the South Sudanese at home are saying that this war is taking longer than they had expected. And today I'm talking to you and you're saying you're willing to negotiate, but it seems like the issues on the table are putting you far apart from each other. Is there anything that will bring you together if there is going to be any negotiations?
Well, yesterday he declared war in his speech, but that does not stop us from if there is a forum for peace talks. Even if the positions are far apart, still it is important to discuss them. Maybe we'll strike an agreement.
That's former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar speaking with John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program. South Africa's nuclear program is 50 years old this week. South Africa is the only country to have produced weapons-grade uranium and then voluntarily dismantle its weapons program to turn its resources towards medical research. Gillian Parker reports from South Africa's nuclear research site at Pelindaba.
South Africa is celebrating the 50th anniversary of its first nuclear reactor under the Atoms for Peace programme. Safari One produces a range of medical isotopes used for diagnosing illnesses such as cancer and cardiac disease. Nuclear medicine produced at the Pelindaba research site is used in about 10 million medical procedures in more than 60 countries every year, saving millions of lives. President Jacob Zuma addressed guests gathered to celebrate the anniversary of the Safari One project.
This child was born when there was no peace, perhaps born precisely because of the situation. 1965, I was doing my second year in Robben Island. So this baby that we are celebrating was born when this country was in a very serious situation. We're celebrating when the country is at its peace with itself.
South Africa's apartheid government pursued a clandestine nuclear weapons program from 1974 to 1990, when the country faced violence at home, war on its borders, and increasing international isolation. The country abandoned its development of weapons of mass destruction in 1993, allowing South Africa to emerge as a champion of nuclear science for peaceful means. South Africa's government has pledged to build a fleet of nuclear power plants to meet a growing demand for electricity. The country is heavily dependent on coal-produced power, and the state power utility Eskom is in crisis due to poor maintenance and planning. Rolling blackouts to alleviate stress on the power grid will continue in the future, curbing mining production and forcing businesses to shut doors at peak times, stifling growth in Africa's most industrialised economy. The CEO of Nuclear Africa, Kelvin Kem, says the government needs to aggressively pursue nuclear energy.
Well, one is to distinguish between the immediate short-term problem of us having very little reserve capacity right now because of the growth that has taken place, and then the longer-term planning for how your future is going to unfold. And I believe it's imminent now in the next few months that some sound decisions have to be made and will be made. Well, for South Africa, I believe nuclear power is absolutely inevitable and essential.
China's Huangdong Nuclear Power Holding Corporation, Russia's Rosatom and France's Areva are among the companies jostling for contracts to build new atomic power plants as part of South Africa's $85 billion nuclear energy program. Critics of the government nuclear energy plans say they will not solve the immediate power crisis, and nuclear projects are prone to cost and time overruns. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Pelindaba.
Every year, tuberculosis kills about 1.3 million people around the world, mostly in developing countries. Martha van der Wolf reports from the outskirts of Addis Ababa on efforts to detect multi-drug-resistant TB with new technology.
Ethiopia is a high-risk country for tuberculosis, ranking third in Africa with over 260 cases per 100,000 people. Bubsha Chota is 28 years old and had TB for 4 years, as doctors did not immediately realize he was suffering from the multi-drug-resistant form of the disease.
I was depressed, like, even when breathing is difficult, you'll be depressed, definitely. Like, I usually tend to stay home. I don't go out that much.
Wapshet was studying to become a medical doctor when diagnosed with tuberculosis in 2009. At the time, blood samples were not tested with the Gene Expert machine, the latest technology in the fight against TB. This machine has increased the detection of multi-drug-resistant TB by almost 50%. There are now 81 of these $35,000 machines in TB labs across Ethiopia. The machine analyzes blood samples in less than 2 hours. Each test is expensive, although the price came down from $17 to $9 per test with the help of organizations such as UNITAID. Wopshet believes that if today's technology had been available when he was diagnosed, he would have recovered more quickly.
Definitely my sputum samples will be sent for Gene Expert assay. So that way it will be detected and I would have been treated 2 years prior to the time I got treated.
Ethiopia has already reached the UN Millennium Development Goal of halting and reducing TB cases by half. The post-2015 goal seeks to reduce TB deaths by 95% by 2035. Nurse Feliku Tsegaye works at Alert, a medical facility where TB patients receive secluded treatment for 2 to 4 months of the 20-month treatment. As TB is easy to transmit to another person by air, Nurse Feliku wears a mouth cap at all times when interacting with the patients. Feliku warns that a higher detection rate will put pressure on their work. She says that now they don't have problems. There's adequate space and medicine to treat patients. Ethiopia now has a TB recovery rate of 70%. It is not clear whether the rate can stay so high as the new and better machines detect more TB patients. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. And good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Senegalese striker Moussa Kone scored in each half, while midfielder Alassane Diallo replied for Mali as hosts Senegal edged Mali 2-1 in semi-final action at the Africa Under-20 Championships in Dakar on Thursday. This is the first time a Senegalese team has reached the finals of an African tournament since the 2002 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, where they were runners-up to Cameroon. On Sunday, Mali played Ghana in the bronze medal playoff, then Senegal challenged Nigeria in the final. Nigeria beat Senegal 3-1 during the group stage of the competition. Meanwhile, South Africa host Madagascar in the Africa Beach Soccer qualifiers tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, Ghana welcome Uganda, Ivory Coast play Mauritius, Egypt face Tanzania as Madagascar and South Africa clash for the second time in 2 days. In Switzerland, France will stage the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, FIFA announced in Zurich on Thursday. Initially, England, New Zealand, South Africa and South Korea bid to stage the event. The field was narrowed down to two, with France getting the nod ahead of South Korea from the FIFA Executive Committee. Staying in Zurich, the 2022 FIFA World Cup will be staged in November and December that year. FIFA confirmed on Thursday the duration of the tournament will be reduced, with the finals being played on the 18th of December to coincide with Qatar's National Day, FIFA revealed. The World Cup is being shifted from its traditional June-July slot as weather conditions are considered to be too hot for the tournament to be played in Qatar in the middle of the calendar year. Meanwhile, Uganda's Cranes replace Bolivia as guests of the Nigeria Super Eagles in a friendly in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State next Wednesday. The Nigeria Football Federation disclosed in Abuja on Thursday. Bolivia announced their withdrawal from the match earlier this week. Finally, in basketball, Nigeria humbled Kenya 82-52 before Mozambique beat hosts South Africa 78-52 at the start of the Four Nations Men's Basketball Challenge in Johannesburg on Thursday. Today, Friday, Mozambique face Kenya, then South Africa challenge Nigeria. On Saturday, South Africa plays Kenya and Nigeria engage Mozambique. After the round-robin contest, the third and fourth teams clash in the bronze medal playoff before the final on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility Thursday for the deadly attack on Tunisia's National Museum that killed 23 people, mostly foreign tourists. The Islamic group's statement described the attack as a blessed invasion of one of the dens of infidels and vice in Muslim Tunisia. Earlier Thursday, Tunisian authorities said they had arrested 9 people in connection with the massacre. That is it for this Friday, March 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as Post Editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jim Harriman, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th for a landmark election. What happens there matters throughout Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. VOA reporters are in Nigeria and surrounding countries covering the campaigns and the issues and counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.